You're listening to 104.3 and 104.7 KHUM. Cutton, Eureka, Arcata, and I don't know, somebody pick a town. Any town.
Redcrest.
Sounds good. All right. We have a ton of wonderful people in here, and we're talking about Harmony and Humboldt today. Do you want to go ahead and introduce yourselves?
My name is Sunshine Johnston, and I came here from Redcrest. I have a farm, Sunbolt Growing, and I also do a cannabis talk show on KMUD called Ganja Tree Talk Radio for the Emerald Empire. It's on the first Sundays of the month from 1:30 to 3 p.m.
And how long have you been doing that talk show?
I've been doing that for maybe about 2.5 years now.
Oh, sweet. Awesome. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Seth Geddes. I'm the owner of Beneficial Living Center in Arcata, a garden store, and one of the partners in Primordial Solutions that does biological gardening products, and definitely specialize in organic approaches and soil remediation and soil biology specifically, and how to save money and time in the garden.
Sweet. Mm-hmm. Awesome.
And my name is Sarah Schutte. I'm with Dirty Business Soil Consulting and Analysis, and we are an agricultural testing laboratory and consulting firm in Arcata, providing agricultural resources to farmers through testing and monitoring and things like that.
How long have you been doing that?
We've been in business for 5 years now.
Oh, cool. Awesome. Yeah.
And I'm Theora Jackson. I'm the director of the Humboldt Sungrowers Guild. And we work with a network of farmers. We have about 240 farm members and growing. And we promote sustainable farming, sun-grown cannabis. And then we also provide access to the True Humboldt brand, which is a statewide brand, to kind of unify farmers and promote Humboldt.
How long has the Humboldt Sungrowers Guild been going on?
Yeah, a little over 2 years.
Okay.
Yeah, so we're still new just because the legal industry is new.
Of course. Yeah. We'll be talking a bit more about that. Go ahead.
My name's Lisandro Salazar. I am the owner and founder of Rain Harvest Systems, design and consulting firm that specializes in sustainable water systems, mainly rainwater harvesting, to help farmers and landowners become sustainable with their water practices.
Awesome. Now, the first question, this is like a larger all-encompassing, but why is sustainable farming practices important? I know in the short term it might seem to have, you know, it might not seem so, but like why, like there's so many benefits to it. I don't really know where to start.
I guess I'll start. That's a very big question.
I know.
But as we've seen throughout years and years of history and the big ag farming, we've done a lot of damage to our soil, a lot of damage to our water resources. And so that's just a huge example of why we should be growing sustainably and organically, because we've seen the destruction. We've already been through this. So I think that we should take a lesson from the past and move forward with better practices.
What is a small, easy, better practice for somebody to go ahead and just start on the road to more sustainable farming?
Gosh, there's a lot of them, but using organic fertilizers instead of chemical fertilizers is a big one. Using beneficial biology, building Seth can speak to this more as well, but building your beneficial biology, because big ag throughout time has been soil killing instead of soil building and soil living. So I think that we need to turn it from soil death to soil life.
And it might seem like a daunting task, but each small step you take will help.
Yeah, like compost teas and adding beneficial, beneficial biology, compost, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Do you have anything to add to that, Seth?
Sure. Well, to address the question of why sustainable agriculture is important, I think we can all get a pretty good sense of the environmental impact that sustainable agriculture brings, the less harm to the environment. But an interesting component is that it's actually more economically feasible to be sustainable, because a short-term gain using chemical nutrients actually depletes the soil, which then results in more complications, reduced systemic resistance to disease, requiring more pesticide applications, which is expensive, the labor, the products. So the there's an economic benefit to being sustainable that is very real.
Yeah, because you have to refertilize every single year if you're using bad fertilizer, right?
Yeah, and I can add to that, you know, building your soil over, you know, at first there's a larger input or upfront cost, but then as you build the soil, you have to do less and less work over time. And so kind of like buying solar panels, for instance, there's the upfront cost, and then you save money over time, and a lot of work in labor cost and fertilizer inputs and pesticides.
Using the chemical fertilizers, it's like it just goes directly right into the plant, as compared to doing biologicals, which create this community around the root system. And that, over time, what that does is the plants will just take up what they need, and so you're already in a more balanced state rather than just dumping or putting chemical fertilizers, especially petroleum-based fertilizers, onto your crop. So it just kind of overrides that whole system and can actually give you more problems with mold and whatnot.
And there's a lot of other things that people can do too. What are some things that people could do as far as conserving water, and so that there is more water for you know, in the long run, because our watersheds are no longer producing as much as they did, like back in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. And so it's a big, even if nobody was, even if water wasn't rerouted at all, like there wouldn't be as much as there was in the 1950s. And so water conservation is really important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things is, if at all possible, putting your plants in the ground rather than raised beds, mm-hmm. or smart pots. That's not available to everybody, I understand, but if that is available to you, definitely build up that soil and get the plants in the ground.
Why does that help with water?
Because there's less evaporative loss, and so when you have like a smart pot above ground, all that surface area around the side walls is also evaporation, just right for evaporation. So if they're in the ground, the only place for evaporation is from the surface as opposed to the side walls. Another practice would be mulching, that you can do living mulch with like a cover crop and companion planting in that way, or just mulching in general that helps keep the reduce evaporative loss off of the surface of the soil.
Oh, cool.
Lots and lots of compost will also help a lot. People have been having success using the hugel culture, which is putting kind of like,
yes,
logs in the ground, and those hold a lot of water and a lot of biology, and so those are like decomposing. And then, lots of compost. Compost has a high water holding capacity, and it's breathable, and it's got lots of nutrients. So if you start taking the time now, I mean, before you know it, a few years will go by, and you will have some really, really good compost. I live in a unique situation where dry farming is an option. And in that case, I don't use mulch. I do what's called dry mulching, where I just break the soil capillaries using like a hula hoe kind of a tool. And so this is a new thing for me, and I'm observing very, very closely, but I will say it's quite successful. It is done across the river in Shively. There are farmers there dry farming their cannabis. And I'm on the other side in Holmes Flat, and I'm also having some great success.
And dry farming means no water at all.
Yeah, that means no water. I only use it during the nursery stage, and then when I transplant and I go into the ground, I actually don't use any water during the transplanting part as well.
Sweet. Well,
I was going to add, strategic irrigation practices. If you're not lucky enough to be dry farming, you can still increase the root depth of a plant by giving it a long duration with a high volume of water. And what it does is it creates a water column that slowly sinks down. And as the roots start to follow that, they start going deeper and deeper, and they start tapping into water that's actually in the water table.
Oh, cool.
Whereas if you just water every single day a little bit on top, you're not really encouraging any root growth to go deep. And then the minerals that they get in the soil are highly more available as well. So it's just another thing to do.
Where can people find out more about that? Just
Google. But there's a lot of good sustainable, you know, ag. A lot of viticulture right now is learning about, you know, dust mulching, and also how to really encourage like really deep root penetration. And then you don't have to irrigate even close to as much as you would expect.
Mm-hmm. And then I also want to add too that one of the things that I'm observing is that the plants, they really don't want a lot of water. You have a lot of problems with too much water. Your branches start breaking. That's one of them, because they just have too much water. And it seems that the plants just really don't want it. They don't want a lot of water, and they also don't want a lot of fertilizer. So something to consider.
Yeah, you think it's a good idea at first, but...
Yeah. Another good thing that no one's mentioned to is just water storage is really good, so you're not pulling from watersheds during the summer, which everyone's pretty aware of. And there will be regulations regarding that. But, you know, just making sure you're set up for that, so you're just watering from stored water or doing rainwater catchment here like Lisandro does. And then the other thing that everybody kind of touched on is the just improving soil structure. And I just wanted to touch back on the container farming and stuff, which seems really popular, and buying bagged soil and all of that. The main difference is the soil structure. There isn't really any structure with bagged soil. And so it dries out really quickly, or it stays too wet too long, and you get a lot of runoff just also just down the sides of a pot. Even if it's not a smart pot, a fabric one, you just get a lot more runoff, and so you're wasting a lot of your nutrients and water in that way, where when you're using soil that's built up properly and has a really good structure, it has a higher water-holding capacity and good exchange capacity with the nutrients. It's more of a better sponge that the plant can draw from. So I just wanted to touch on that.
I want to let anyone know out there, if they have any questions, they can always email studio@khm.com and it'll get to us. You can also text 786-FOLK, which is 707-786-3655, just in case anyone has any questions for you all. Mm-hmm. I just want to go ahead and fill people in on Harmony and Humboldt. The Humboldt Sun Growers Guild and the Eel River Recovery Project have kind of gotten together in order to promote Harmony and Humboldt, which is something that we're talking about during this panel right here. And I want to go ahead and invite people to come on out to the quarterly farmers meeting, which is going on this Friday on over at the Bayside Grange. And it's open to all prospective guild members. You don't have to be a part of the guild to pop on by, and that's from 4:30 until 8 over at the Bayside Grange, once again in Arcata. Plus, the Eel River Recovery Project is giving away a Polaris side-by-side quad runner four-wheeler as a part of a fundraiser so that they can get some money to do what they do best. And we're going to go ahead and take a short break, and then we'll have a little bit more of this discussion going on in just a little bit. You're listening to KHUM. You're listening to KHUM. We're having a Harmony and Humboldt panel going on right now where we're talking about sustainable cannabis practices. And I want to remind people about the quarterly farmers meeting for the Humboldt Sun Growers Guild. It's happening at 4:30 over at the Bayside Grange in Arcata this coming Friday. And we were just talking about better water practices, and the Water Board has new proposed regulations. Would you like to talk about that for a second?
So the State Water Board is what we're talking about, not the North Coast Regional Water Board.
Thanks for making the clarification.
They've had theirs out, and now the state has their proposed regs, which comment closed for that last Wednesday. So hopefully they take everybody's comments into account. And the main just issues for it was... for us, because everybody's been working so hard to be compliant with the Regional Water Board, is there's just little discrepancies on just certain regs that might make it more difficult for farmers to become compliant. And a lot of them have spent a lot of money becoming to get into compliance with the Regional Board. And then depending on what comes out for the State Water Board, they might have to redo stuff or spend more. So a couple of those things are just an increased forbearance period of about a month and a half, so a longer time period that you cannot draw water from a local water source, whether, spring or whatever it is. So that could be hard. So you would have to increase your water storage and estimates, and then also increase setbacks.
between 50 and 100 feet, which, you know, a lot of people have set up their whole property and done this whole plan based on the regional setbacks, and then now these other setbacks might be increased. Again, it's not set in stone, so we'll see what they come out with. We're hoping that they, in certain situations, can defer back to the regional board and allow the regional board to make allowances for folks that are unable to fully comply with the state regs if they do, you know, are a little more stringent. But the regional water board can make allowances because we do have a lot more water up here than, say, Southern California. Mm-hmm. And these are statewide regs. So, you know, we're hoping that they take into account that have a totally different climate and region up here and, you know, water amount. And the other main thing is just a lot of monitoring. So all the farmers are going to have to monitor all the water that they use whenever they use it, which could be daily. So it's just a lot of work, paperwork, and that kind of thing.
They just had the public comment on this, and so it still has another little bit before the state regulations go into effect.
Yeah, a month or two. I'm not sure what the deadline is for when they're going to release it, but they need to release it before the end of the year.
Can people look at it online yet?
You can look at what the draft was. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You just go to the State Water Board website and they have the full draft regulations up there. But unfortunately, you can't make any comment on it. So it's sort of just in their hands now. And we'll see what happens.
Definitely sounds pretty stringent.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, just about the... I know it is extra work to monitor water and whatnot, but I'm not currently doing it right now. But one of the things about doing that is you will get a better idea of just your overall farm practices and how much mm-hmm. water are you using. Mm-hmm. And so it's good because then you can start to figure out how to use that water in a better way, and it just kind of gets your mind working that way. And so it's good. And then also just the need to be getting more data, so we just have a better idea of how much water is being used in the state, really, because they're going to be getting all these numbers across the state. And then through that, we can start to figure out better water budgets and what's going on. The Eel River Recovery Project is collecting some water data on things like stream flow, temperatures. And there's a number of gauges out looking at the temperatures across the Eel River watershed. So we'll see what kind of information can come from that.
I completely agree, and I think that all farmers should have a water meter on any of their water tanks that they utilize. Not only, if let's just say that daily, you know, water monitoring comes to fruition. If you're going to your water system every day and you're checking to see how much water you're using, all of a sudden you have so much more of a grasp on what's actually going on on your farm. And you can also find things like leaks. Oh my gosh, for some reason I lost 500 gallons more, but I didn't water anymore yesterday. What's going on? Oh, I might need to walk down to that greenhouse. Oh shoot, someone left the hose on. I would have never known that. Or let me knock on my tanks to see how much water I have. Oh gosh, you know, this thing was overflowing. We have to close that valve. I think being more present with our, you know, energy and water is going to help everyone get a better idea of how to just, you know, just be more aware and connect to their plants a little bit more.
It's definitely good to be more aware.
Yeah.
What can people do to plan?
I mean, there's lots. I mean, people have been doing this for months and months now as far as planning, but, you know, I can speak to what I do with people when they come to me for information on trying to get information on water planning is, you know, trying to figure out how much you've used in the past. If you have any information, then that's good. And then seeing what kind of sources of water that you have. All greenhouses are potential massive sources of water in Humboldt County. You can basically capture as much water that you'll need in the entire year for at least one season of your crop off of your greenhouse just through rain catchment. So seeing how much water you have, seeing where you can put your storage, gravity feed is always preferred. And if not, then solar pumping is always secondary to that. And then tertiary, you can do, you know, some kind of electrical or generator if you have to. And then just kind of figuring out how much water you have, where you're going to put it, and then really doing as much as you can to minimize it through drip irrigation or just other forms of mulching and composting. And so it's super comprehensive, and it's very case by case. But, you know, the first thing is you got to know how much you need, you got to know how much you got, and then you got to figure out how to increase the two or increase one and decrease the other and see if you can stay within that balance.
Yeah, and you have to be aware as to, you know, where you're located and everything else like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just even, not to mention the state, but it seems like Humboldt, Mendocino, Del Norte, and Trinity counties, it's so different, all the different microclimates that are around here. It's
Yeah, and that's why, you know, information is really key, because it allows you better optics on your farm. And you do have to monitor on farm, because, like you said, you know, the microclimates and, you know, everybody's sites are so specific and different and unique. And so monitoring on your own farm allows you optics to be able to farm more efficiently. So data collection is important. It can be very cumbersome. One of my clients, he has a flow meter on his main tank, and he just says every day, you check your tanks every day anyway, as you should. Mm-hmm. And he just gets out his phone and snaps a picture of it. So he just has a picture log instead of maybe a hand log. But you can keep a log at each of your stations, create standard operating procedures so that everybody knows what to do, when to do it, and you have a certain time of the day and how many times a day and where those clipboards are located, and just having a plan to, you know, this gets us out of fire drill mode. We've been operating in fire drill mode and reaction mode for a long time, and these regulations are going to force us to prepare and plan, which I think is a really good thing in that sense, although there are some challenging regulations to hurdle, but at the end of the day, it really does allow us better optics on our farm.
Which is really cool. Awesome. And I want to remind people that the Humboldt Sun Growers Guild quarterly meeting is coming up this Friday at 4:30 over at the Bayside Grange in Arcata. And there, the Eel River Recovery Project is actually going to be giving away a Polaris side-by-side quad runner. They're using that as their fundraiser to help. And you can also get more information about the Eel River Recovery Project, and there's some really good best practices on their website over at eelriverrecovery.org. So putting that out there too. Awesome. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll get back into the tunes. We'll get back into the discussion, rather, here in just a couple minutes. You're listening to KHUM, and right now we're having a panel here just talking about good, best practices whenever it comes to cannabis farming here in Humboldt. And let's go ahead and move to the subject of pollution and how to, you know, not contribute to it.
Sediment yield is one of the worst things for the fish and to the water and rivers here. And so reducing sediment yield in how you move dirt around and whatnot is of a big deal, and a lot of it is in our road systems. And if you look at the new ordinance that Humboldt County, the new draft of the ordinance, there are some things on there about roads, including your road associations. It's worth looking at. And the roads are the biggest point source of pollution, and it's quite costly to fix roads. I know farmers are already starting to find that out and work on that, but it's the best thing that we can do for the fish. And also, having your roads looked at and just being aware of your point sources. And the other thing is not dumping. It's where you put your old soil and where you put those piles. So the Regional Water Board has definitely gotten us more aware about where those piles are going and if water is getting involved and causing pollution. And back in the old days, or maybe even still today, there are some bad practices of taking old soil from, like, say, indoor grows and dumping it in the river. And this is, like, not a good – this is a terrible thing to do. The perlite in the river is not good for the fish, and not using – moving away from perlite in your farming practices is also encouraged.
What exactly does it do to the fish?
Apparently, it's not good for their to eat it.
Yeah, they think it's food.
And then it ends up poisoning them.
Mm-hmm. And perlite is basically just it's like puffed glass.
Mm.
Oh, gosh.
So
I can't imagine.
I can only imagine what that's doing inside their bodies.
Oh, yeah. And then if any wildlife eats that?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it just sounds like a really bad thing.
Yeah, and then just in general, you know, historically, we've always just dumped our excess potting media, you know, year after year. We'd dump it and buy new soil. And that was one of the basis for me starting my company in the first place, was just to get people to stop throwing their soil over the hill and into the river. I thought, if I can just stop people from doing that, that's a huge environmental impact, you know. So reusing your soil is big. I know that some type, like Sunshine was saying, nursery stock, you know, you have to dump that soil somewhere. But, you know, soil decomposes and breaks down. You can always add that back to your pots or your beds. And then also another plug for just trying to get back to the native soil. Mm-hmm. I'm from the Midwest, and I remember posting on Facebook once upon a time asking if anybody had used soil that I could have or that they were throwing away. And some of my friends were like, what does that even mean? Use soil? Somebody's throwing away soil? Mm-hmm. And in, you know, agriculture in the Midwest, no one would even think of scraping up all that soil, acres and acres of prime farm soil, dumping it, and then buying new soil to put in its place.
Sounds kind of crazy when you think about it, right?
Yeah, and granted, this is potting media, not native soil, but same thing. It can be reused. It doesn't go bad. You just need to understand how to maintain it.
And also the very worst, I mean, even if you're native soil, you think, gosh, I cannot grow anything in the soil. It's too compacted. It has too much clay or whatever the issues are. If you start, if you dig some holes and you just start composting in those holes and just start making compost, you can grow in the ground, in holes, in your native soil.
Yeah, you can build soil out of anything, you know, given enough time and energy.
Mm-hmm. And cover cropping, too, is really important in the winter. Just if you have exposed soil, doing cover crops, that kind of keeps soil erosion down if you have an open area, and prevents runoff from rain and the sediment. And then also, you know, you let it die back, and then in the beginning of the year you till it in, and that continues to build the soil, naturally compost in there. You get nitrogen fixing that way as well. So that's a really good practice, is doing cover crops in the winter.
Yeah, and those cover crops really take up those nutrients and, like she said, allows them to return the nutrients to the soil in the spring. And that also reduces your fertilizer cost because you're actually scavenging for those nutrients during the winter instead of letting them leach out and wash away.
Mm-hmm. Which makes a lot of sense.
Some practical things on how to reduce pollution. One of the number one things I see is an over-fertilization of phosphorus in particular. Mm-hmm. There's a mentality coming from the era of when people were cultivating inside that, I mean, I'll address that first, is this high porous soil that drains and dries fast and you feed with every watering. Mm-hmm. And that's a practice that is effective for indoor cultivation. But as we transition into outside, people need to adapt new practices, which is what we're talking about. But phosphorus in particular is one of the main components in runoff into the watersheds that causes algal blooms, which then, you know, does the same thing in the ocean, and then the algae dies and decomposes at deep depths and high pressure and causes carbonic acid, which is, you know, carbon in solution, which is acidification of the oceans. So... and this goes beyond just cannabis. Mm-hmm. Big ag in general is over applying phosphorus. So less phosphorus is a good practical thing. And then if you are reusing your soil, or if you're not reusing your soil, sorry, wherever you put it, you can do an infiltration basin mm-hmm. downslope, mm-hmm. Dig a ditch and just mm-hmm. fill it with high carbon wood chips, for example. So then when the rain hits it, mm-hmm. any of the leachate that is running off from your old soil goes mm-hmm. into this little basin full of microbes that are all immobilizing all the nutrients and mm-hmm. preventing it from going into the watershed.
And yeah, also to add to that, studies have been done on the hemp plant, which is that's just the same as the cannabis plant. And what they found with the hemp plant is that it does need nitrogen, but it actually doesn't use a lot of phosphorus, or it uses very little phosphorus. So consider just backing off on the phosphorus. The one time that I do find myself using it is during cold spells. A little bit of phosphorus to kind of help bring up the energy of the plant, and I've been pretty successful with that.
Okay, awesome.
Yeah, and there's detriments to over-fertilizing to the plant as well, because although we think that the plant needs lots of nitrogen, we pump it full of nitrogen, it's also ripe for pests and pathogens. They really like the excess nitrogen, and then you have this big, lush, luscious plant that is just teeming, and so it really does encourage pests and pathogens, as well as the runoff into the rivers. And one of the things that we're all going to have to pay attention to coming out with the state draft regulations, their regulations are not set in stone yet, still draft, but they're going to require a nutrient or nitrogen management plan, and you're only going to be able to use a certain amount of nitrogen each season and at any given time. And then one of the people at the Ag Department was kind of upset that they didn't address a phosphorus management plan as well for the exact reasons that we're talking about. And nitrogen is really mobile, and you need to apply it more frequently, less concentrated, like less amount, and then more over time, whereas phosphorus tends to stick in the soil. So that's where, when you're throwing the soil into the river, that's when the phosphorus really gets into the river, because it sticks to soil particles, and then you're dumping it it's through like physical wasting. So just things to pay attention to. It's not good for the environment, but it's also not good for the plant. And then over-fertilizing with phosphorus creates lockout of nutrients in the soil too. So by trying to give your plant more phosphorus, you're actually binding up other nutrients, and the plant's not getting that phosphorus, nor is it getting the other nutrients that it's hanging out with. So there's a lot of reasons to not over-fertilize, and pay attention to that.
Yeah, it goes back to the cover crops and the use of cover crops. And I just saw how that worked for myself, and was doing a bit of an experiment this year where I had the soil tested, and I added some biochar, that a one-time investment of biochar that came with some powdered basalt rock. And that's it. And then I took the grass and the cover crop that was growing, mowed it down, and then that got plowed and flipped over. I used a handful of compost from the neighbor, that all the native microorganisms, but I didn't really add any I didn't add any soil amendments or fertilizer. And it is amazing what that cover crop, it just completely decomposed. By the time I planted, even 5 weeks later, it was just gone. It had been eaten up and turned into nutrients. So getting to the point of just, I mean, I'm going to stick with this not using fertilizer and just stick with the cover crops. So if you can get some cover crops out this year, now's the time to get the seed on hand and be prepared for the rain and see what happens, because they grow great without fertilizer.
I think backing up too, and just remembering that a lot of this pollution or excess nutrients is really coming from the water, and it's taking it off the farm and it's flowing it into the river, and that's where we're creating, you know, hurting these fish and all the other little animals. Is just being aware of your impervious surfaces on your, you know, the farm that you're living on or working on, and knowing how much water that really is. So just around here, a 1,000 square foot greenhouse is about 20,000 minimum 20,000 gallons of water just streaming off that every year. And so you go to properties that have, you know, 20 of those, or huge greenhouses. I was just at a place that was about 500,000 gallons. I figured out after the end of the rainy season, that was just flowing right into this little, you know, class 3 stream that was definitely going into the river. And we also figured out that farmer was going to be using almost that much for his crop. So it's like, oh, you have 500,000 gallons going into the river with all this pollutants, or you have 500,000 gallons stored, or whatever number it is for next year, and then you haven't just drained all that stuff into the river. So just, you know, being aware of your impervious surfaces, and definitely trying to keep all water on site, infiltrating as much as possible, because at that point it's actually helping the land. You're not creating erosion control or sediment in the river, and, you know, those nutrients are going to slowly get into the soil rather than just show up in the rivers all of a sudden. Yeah.
Now, the Eel River Recovery Project, Sunshine, you want to talk about some of the things that some of the projects that Eel River Recovery Project is currently working on?
Yeah, I'm a board member with the Eel River Recovery Project, and so we're doing some of the flow, we're getting some of the water temperatures We're also checking up on the algae blooms that happen. We're collecting some water samples. I will say that I do live on the banks of the Eel River, and for the past 4 years, or for 3 years, I was getting swimmer's itch when I'd swim in the river later in the summer. And this year, the water temperatures are cooler, and I'm not getting swimmer's itch. And I swim every day, and it's great. And I'm
what
really,
is swimmer's itch?
It's like it's in the algae, and it kind of it kind of just hooks onto your skin, and you have a little. It causes your immune system to kind of flare up and itchy, and it'll itch for about a week, and it's just kind of a bummer. But having grown up here, I never really experienced it until just recently with this current drought. And the other thing that the Eel River Recovery Project is doing this fall is they do a salmon Chinook. They go out and they count the fish, and that is really, really fun. They get people scuba gear and go out there, mask and snorkels, and they start counting. And that, if you want to get a hold of Pat Higgins, you can call him at the Eel River Recovery, the action line, which is 707-223-7200. And you can give him a call and, yeah, sign up for that. And then there's also just going out and getting all the pike, the pick, what are they?
Pike
minnow. They're getting, those are all over in the river, and they eat the salmon eggs, and they eat the baby salmon. So trying to get less in those populations is also some of the efforts. And, yeah, so this is the Harmony in Humboldt, and this event will be going on at the
Basic.
At the Bayside Grange on Thursday. There's going to be
Friday.
Some... Friday. Is it Friday?
Friday, yeah.
Usually it's on Thursday. No,
it's Friday. Yeah.
Okay. It's on Friday.
It's okay. Most of the time I don't know what day of the week it is either.
And it's going to be... I've been going to these quarterly meetings, and they are really, really fun. There's guests. Who were the guests for this one?
Yeah, so on Friday we're going to have Tara Carver speak about a lot of the upcoming regs, the draft regs, what to expect for 2018, information that was in the trailer bill that was passed a little while ago. And she represents the Humboldt County Growers Alliance, excuse me. So she'll be speaking for about an hour from 5 to 6. Then we're going to do... we're going to have Barry Nocton is our new CEO of the Humboldt Sun Growers Guild. And so he's just a quick note from him about our plans for the future. We'll do the drawing for the Polaris. And then Patrick is going to speak about the Eel River Recovery Project so people can learn about that a lot more in depth. And get a chance to, you know, get more raffle tickets and sign up and be a member of the EERP. And, yeah, we always have food and drink, and it's a good gathering opportunity for farmers to network with each other. And all these great folks here will be there because we team up with local businesses to kind of give our members discounts and incentives and that kind of thing to make things more economically affordable for them.
The Sun Growers Guild has just been great at helping us farmers just get an edge up and being successful, and I'm really just really been happy with all the workshops and people coming to those meetings and talking with us about what's happening. And then also, if you want to get tickets to win this Polaris, the Sun Growers Guild has an office, and it's in... It's you tell
it's
people
between,
where to go.
Yeah, between Arcata Eureka and the Breakit Industrial Park, so behind the France Bakery outlet. So you can stop by there, find out more about the guild, get raffle tickets if you'd like. And then we also have raffle tickets at the Trinity River Garden Center, Beneficial Living Center, which Seth owns here, Soilscape Solutions, Humboldt Depot, Redwood Garden Supply in Myers Flat, Sylvandale Gardens, and DZ's Supply in Redway.
Hey, awesome. And you can pop on over there. They're about $25.
Yeah. Or you can get five for $100 if you really want to go for it.
Yeah. This is how we do it. This is how we do it in Humboldt.
What is the Eel River Recovery Project going to use the money from this fundraiser for?
Well, we're trying to get some grants together to just carry on and further some of the efforts.
Okay. Awesome. And this will definitely help you in that way.
Oh, yeah, for sure. We definitely want to keep doing the citizen monitoring and collecting data of the rivers.
And will people be able to still purchase tickets on Friday on over at the quarterly meeting?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, awesome. So you can just come on over to the quarterly meeting and pick them up there as well.
Yeah, see what we're all about. And like I said, learn about Eel River recovery. And
I just want to remind listeners that they don't have to be a member to come to the quarterly meeting.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. All prospective guild members.
And it's a really great resource. It's a free resource, and I think that everybody should just, you know, come out and at least check it out. It can't hurt to learn new information and stay abreast of the regulations that are coming out that are going to affect everybody.
What are some of the workshops that you all have put together?
So we do workshops like in the off season. We do monthly workshops, and I think almost all these folks have done them. Yeah, Sarah's done one on IPM, so integrated pest management, and her and Sunshine did a talk, I guess, last week on the russet mite issue. So hopefully next year everybody will be a little more prepared for that.
We want to make sure that we don't hit, August and September or October for that matter. We don't want to see you coming into our office freaking out from russet mite takedown. So we want to see you in there earlier in February and March to plan how we are going to not get taken down by these buggers next year.
Yeah. And Seth here has done a workshop on regenerative soil and soil building and soil biology, which was very well attended, so that was a good one. And then Lisandro also did one on rain catchment and water storage and that kind of thing, which everyone, again, should be thinking about now, preparing for the winter, making sure you're getting your water storage available. And, of course, he's available to come out to your site and do an assessment and kind of give you an idea of what kind of rain catchment setup you can get together.
You want to be prepared. The bulk tank.
We do. We have incentives to get bulk tanks that are 50,000 gallons.
50,000 gallon tanks, really.
Oh, cool. If you have space for that. So it does require, you know, permitting and everything for to install something of that size. But, you know, it has even its own rain catchment top and everything. So it collects its own water as well as that from other sources on your property.
And the Humboldt Sun Growers Guild, if somebody joins the guild, then they also have access to the True Humboldt brand. What is the...
Yeah, and that's kind of... I was going to speak to the sustainability in general. You know, we're not just talking about environmental sustainability and that kind of thing. It's also about economic sustainability. And that is a big part of our mission with the Humboldt Sun Growers Guild is... having the ability for all these small farms in our community to unify, get educated, keep up to date on everything, and then also be able to have an impact in the cannabis market by being unified under one brand. So that's what the True Humboldt brand is. The mission for that is promoting sun-grown, sustainable cannabis. So a lot of our education, you know, we're trying to raise the bar and... yeah, so that's pretty much like...
Do you already have to be compliant to join the guild?
You don't. You have to be going through the permit process. So, you know, there are only so many permits that have been issued. A lot of people are in process. You know, next year, some people will get sorted out, unfortunately. But, yeah, as long as you're in process of going, you know, becoming permitted, which... pretty much everybody by now or very shortly has had to have submitted their complete application with the county. And then 2018 we'll have the opportunity to apply for the state, you know, licenses and that kind of thing, permits.
Does it cost anything
to
join the
guild? Yes, it does. We, we're membership based. So we, there's different levels of membership and, you can learn about that if you come by the quarterly on Friday, or you can stop by the offices.
And the quarterly meeting's free, right?
Quarterly meeting's free. Yeah, you can just stop by, and we give a lot of information for free. But our the office number is 707-444-TRUE, which is 8783. So you can call, make an appointment with me at any time to just go over what we offer more in detail and that kind of thing. So, yeah, we don't want to end up as another boom-bust industry like gold and fisheries and lumber. We want cannabis to
be sustainable. And, you know, it's a really integral and important aspect of our economy in Humboldt, and we need to keep it alive.
And once again, the meeting is going on Friday at 4:30, and we'll actually be broadcasting from there a little bit earlier, from 4 until 7. But from 4:30 until 8 over the Bayside Grange, which is at 2297 Jacoby Creek Road, on over there in Arcata. And, the quarterly farmers meeting, you can come. All prospective guild members can pop on by. There's going to be music, food, speakers. It's going to be pretty exciting and fun. Yeah. Does anybody else have anything else you want to talk about while we're here? Okay, awesome. I'll go ahead and put the information up online about the Eel River Recovery Project, and also the Humboldt Sun Growers Guild, as well as the quarterly meeting happening on Friday, on our website here in just a little bit. Awesome. Thanks, you all, for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us. Mm-hmm.
We're going to go ahead and take a short break, and then we'll get back into some more tunes in just a bit. You're listening to KHOM.